other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast on the internet sponsored by Pumpkinhead's Pumpkin Patch. My name's Aaron, here with my personal pals Dave.
Hey boys.
Brick.
I feel like we've had more than one sponsor that have trademarked.
Yeah. This one was a question of what is that pumpkin patch? What does it mean? Is it a pumpkin patch full of pumpkins? Is it his personal patch on his body? Lots of questions.
It sounds like there was two.
Yeah. In a pandemic, more than one counts as many. And then we have Old Irish Nico calling in from overseas.
Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mentioned, so obviously this is Spooktober. We're right now terrified, as we are all month. We've talked a lot in the past about books that were scary, that, you know, scary reads for us in especially childhood. And one title has come up over and over again is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. So we might as well go ahead and read this thing again and talk about it because we mentioned it so often. This was a collection of like folklore, basically, right? Would you call it? Like, it's not, these aren't original stories.
Yeah.
No.
Collected and interpreted by Alvin Schwartz, published in 1991. No, 81, sorry. With art by Stephen Gamel, who is an illustrator, who I'll probably talk about quite a bit in this episode, but I want to hold off on the illustrations for now until we get deeper into the stories. I first read these courtesy of the Scholastic Book Fair. I'm sure that most of you had the same experience, right?
Hell,
I feel like
yeah.
Every kid got these in the book fair.
I didn't.
No? Did you?
Dave was born an old man, though, so.
I don't know why, and I don't really remember a lot of my classmates reading this either, even though it came out. Like, so you said 81. I was, what, 3 or 4 years old? So
yeah, I'm surprised at that, actually, because I didn't encounter it until I was in, like, third grade. But it must have just been, like, in constant print.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it was one of those that was, like, $1 per book. Because it's, like, very small, very short.
Yeah, it's short. I mean, it's for kids, so it's, like, a quick, easy read. It's pretty big print. The stories are, like, 100 words, 200 words tops. It's not very long.
Three of them.
Yeah, they're multiple volumes.
I was surprised by how little effort went into the writing of it, because it's like, it's almost like a joke book. Like, it's not, it's as if somebody is telling you a story that they don't totally remember. And it's like, there's very few details, and it just kind of like hits the punchline and then moves on to the next one. There's no embellishment. It's like, it's a really weird book to read as an adult.
Yeah, I don't know if this dude ever wrote anything else that was, I think he wrote a lot of books, but I don't know if any of them are actually good. I read this book so much as a kid, and so did other kids I knew, that we were able to tell these stories without the book. And I think that was kind of the point of it.
Well, yeah, the title is To Tell in the Dark, right? The title sort of has a command in it,
right? I think it's purposeful. You know, it's not like Goosebumps, where there's tons of effort put into, you know, not that Goosebumps are the most effortful books ever, but there's embellishment and, you know, extraneous details and things to flesh them out. These are just straight, hey, you're right, Nico. It's like, here's just the bare bones of the story, because...
So what, like, here's the gist, and then you add whatever details you want when you tell the story to your friends or whatever?
Yeah, and I don't want to, like, impart too much assumption on the author, but these are all stories taken from folklore and oral tradition.
Yeah, Alan Schwartz was a folklorist. That was his focus.
Yeah, so it seems like it's not an effort to archive classical folklore stories. It seems like an effort to profit.
Yeah, this is like a hub for children to continue telling these stories and to, like you said, add their own twists and sort of details onto them.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we'll get to the drawings later, but the drawings take up almost as much real estate in the book as the
words. Oh, yeah, in the book, for sure. I would say imagination much more.
It take a lot more mental real estate.
Right, like this book without the illustrations. We'll probably talk about that later.
Let's go do it now. We're on the topic anyway. The illustrations are scary as fuck.
They're fucking scary.
they're so scary. Upsetting. So Stephen Gamel, the illustrator, I think they're an old like watercolor, it looks like. I can't quite tell. They're very like... fibrous, right? The drawings that had there's tendrils, and like they all have these, like, I feel like you can feel the material in the illustrations, like the hair or the grass or the tattered coat, whatever, like streams of gore off like zombies' faces, whatever. That's the part that fucked me up the most. It really is horrifying.
I can see that doing bad things to me as a kid, for sure.
Yeah, and when I think about this book, it's like reading as a kid, I think about the illustrations first. And almost entirely, and then sometimes recall the specific stories they're tied to, but mostly just the illustration. There was the one about, I think it was not the one we read today, but one of the follow-ups or sequels, the one about the woman with the her head sewn on, right?
Yeah, with the one with the ribbon.
Like, don't untie the ribbon, yeah, and her head falls off. That illustration, I think, was, I remember being very upsetting.
It just kind of feels like without the illustrations, would this book have been anything? Would you guys have even cared about it as a kid?
No. I mean, if it had gotten to me, I probably would have liked it, but I don't think it would have gotten to me. Like found its way to me.
And it wouldn't have been a sensation. Like, this was a thing. Everyone in my class read this, and everyone was talking about it. Everyone, like, people had copies, and it was like a big deal to like share them or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I think you're right. The illustrations made that a phenomenon. It wasn't like we were going to be like, oh, I read this.
Check out this great folklore from Kansas.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but like Nico Wendigo said, the text kind of sucks. So yeah, without the picture, without the illustration, it just feels like this wouldn't even be a book.
But I feel like it's good enough for kids, right?
Yeah, it's definitely good enough for kids. I think so. Because it's not so dry that it's not interesting, right? And the stories are still scary. They're just slight.
It seems like it's too shitty to be for adults, more so than it's designed for kids. It's almost like a joke book, you know, that's like, that has, you know, like 1,001 jokes or whatever, but they're all, so it's like, well, that's for kids. Especially back in the days of the Scholastic, all the Scholastic books, like half the books were like that. They were just completely shitty and they were terribly made. And like they would fall apart, but it was just like, well, just for kids, you know, we'll sell them for $1 and then almost like a cash in.
Yeah.
The same ones I had as a kid.
Some of the writing though, I mean, you're right. Like it's not great, but some of it is pretty evocative. The end of the babysitter one's pretty good.
Yeah, I agree.
That last paragraph, just then a door upstairs opened. The man they had never seen before started down the stairs toward them. As they ran from the house, he was smiling in a very strange way. Like even in that last night, I was like, that's kind of a disturbing image.
Is that the phone call or the babysitter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the babysitter.
Yeah,
but then the last line is a few minutes later the police found him and they arrested him, and it's like, oh, okay, so there's like that sort of sense of resolution, but not all of them have that. Some of them don't, and it's very interesting which ones are a lot darker than the ones that sort of have like a safe ending.
I don't know, I still there's room for elaboration in all of these, and I think it's purposeful that that's being left to it really feels to me the intent of this book is for someone to remember
the gist,
the important parts, and then tell them again. And like I said, that's exactly what we did. We, you know, you'd tell these around the campfire and stuff, and you didn't have the book with you when you did it.
It does.
So everyone's version is a little different, you know.
I don't know. Telling, I guess, how much of it made it into like pop culture. What was the first movie where it was like the calls coming from inside the house?
That Scream.
Well,
not the first movie.
No, there's that one. Yeah. It's called The Calls Coming from Inside the House.
Was that before this book?
Yeah, that was in the 70s with Carole King, I think.
Yeah.
Carole King, sorry. Carole King's the singer.
She felt the earth move under her feet.
God damn it. Yeah, keep talking.
There's a scary tapestry of spooks. No?
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, 79, When a Stranger Calls is the first movie version of that, I think. But the legend, I think, has been around for a long time. Oh, the 1950 murder of teenage babysitter Janet Crispin is commonly said as the birth.
So there's that, which seems to kind of be like one of those urban legends. And then there's like the stories like the Viper, where it's like, that's a joke.
But it says like there's a whole section at the end it says like not meant to scare you. These are
or something. Yeah, I mean, the book's organized in a weird way. Like, there's a song section. There's a joke section. Did you guys get a chance to watch that? You might not have. There's a documentary about it, about these.
No,
I was going to watch that. I also wanted to watch the movie that Guillermo del Toro made a couple years ago.
I watched that also. It was fine. It wasn't great. It was...
It could be hard.
It didn't... You can tell it borrowed some of the stories from it, but it wasn't leaning that heavily. Like, it could easily just have been its own thing.
Right.
You know? Like, Harold's in there and the toe's in there.
Right.
It lends from it, but it's not. But the documentary is, like, not that great of a documentary, but it's also, you know, it's interesting enough. Just kind of learn a little bit about Schwartz, but a lot of it focuses on the impact that the books had on kids.
Right.
And sort of, you know, everyone that's interviewed is some kind of shitty creative as an adult that credits them. But there's a whole section on the effort to have these banned.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because of the illustrations?
I think so, yeah. You know, in the same vein as what happened with Dungeons & Dragons, or, you know, later in the 90s with like, you know, Mortal Kombat and Night Trap and all that. Mm. This was one of the ones that was flogged for a while as, like, ruining kids' brains and, like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
But they got... So on the documentary, they brought on a folklorist who was also, like, on one of the school committees in the 80s or 90s or whatever, when they were trying to ban it, and she was talking about, like, yeah, they're pretty scary, but also they're not like gratuitous, or they're not reveling. Like, a lot of them are just sort of normalizing death as something that's like part of being human. And she's like, there's a lot of value in that, as well as, you know, these aren't things that this dude wrote. They're things he collected. And like the fact that you have kids like going to a library and asking for books, and the books have heritage in them, even if it's has this, you know, outer layer of appealing imagery that's, you know, kind of a little taboo for what is acceptable for kids in comparison to, you know, everything else around at the time. She's like, that's, you know, there's a lot of value in kids getting to experience that.
Yeah, like nothing here is so scary that it would like ruin your life or like traumatize you, don't think. Like the scares are pretty,
some of the pictures are,
yeah, I mean they're, but they, yeah, I guess they definitely stick with you for sure. But you're right, like it's not, the things that are scary here aren't things that I think would be damaging to kids to read. It seemed pretty like this is a it's possible to experience and like overcome fear, right?
Right.
As a child.
Yeah.
Did you, I read this for today's discussion, did any stories stand out to you as being particularly good, or the ones that you liked or didn't like? Any of you?
I think one that's weird, that it's not a very good story, kind of like Nico was saying, like it's not written that well. It's super short, but it sticks with you a little bit, is the one with the headlights.
Yeah. Totally.
Oh yeah.
High beams.
Yeah, high beams, yeah. Which is like, you know, so the whole story is this girl's driving and there's a truck following her flashing the beams and she's getting scared, and then the twist in the end is actually there's like a murderer in the car and the person with the high beams kept flashing them on to scare the killer from like stabbing her.
Yeah.
It's a good example of like the story itself is not that good, but the like story is good, you know?
Yeah. One thing I liked about this read through is that section in the end where he kind of explains where the stories came from in some ways. So I feel like that's, for an adult, that's the most interesting stuff, is like, oh wow, this is like, these details were changed here and there. I like that part quite a bit. The Wendigo, I read that and I was like, wait a minute, Wendigos aren't fucking these. So then I did some research and I was like, oh, the Wendigo, or maybe he explains it in the end of the book, or I can't remember, that Wendigos, there's multiple interpretations of them. Because I'm familiar with the monster Wendigo, which is my favorite Wendigo. Not the scary wind Wendigo, which sucks.
I thought that was one of my favorite illustrations, the one in the Wendigo with the footprints and footsteps. The trees. Were, yeah, it was really well done.
I wanted Nico to explain the one with the Irish nonsense. Which one was that? It was early on with the, like the boy says, or like the dog says the thing, like sings the song. It's like some sort of Gaelic. Me tie Doughty Walker.
Wait, what? Okay, what page is it on?
It's on page 14. There was a haunted house where every night a bloody head fell on the chimney. At least that's what the people said, so nobody would stay there overnight. Then a rich man offered $200 to whoever would do it, and this boy said it was all... this boy said he would try if he could have his dog with him, so it was all settled. The very next night, the boy went to the house with his dog to make it more cheerful. He started a fire in the fireplace. Then he sat in front of the fire and waited, and his dog waited with him. For a while, nothing happened, but after a little after midnight, he heard someone singing softly and sadly off in the woods, and singing sounded like something like this. Me tie Doughty Walker. It was just somebody singing, the boy told himself, but he was frightened. Then his dog answered the song. Softly and sadly, it sang, Linchy, Kinchy, Collie, Molly, Dingo, Dingo. And it goes on like this. And I was like, Nico must know this, the situation here. What's going on with this?
No idea.
You've not learned from your old Irish experiences what Me tie Doughty Walker means?
Is it Irish?
It's not in the notes either.
It sounds kind of like Gaelic, right? I don't know if it is technically, but to me I was like, oh, it sounds like Irish.
Why isn't that in the notes section?
Was it? Let's see.
This is a retelling of a Kentucky tale collected by Herbert Halpert in Bloomington, Indiana in 1940. Informant was Miss Otis Milby Melcher. For Dr. Halpert's transcription of the tale and the interview with the informant, see HFB 1.911. The story appears under the title The Rash Dog and the Bloody Head. It has been expanded slightly in line with the informant's published suggestions for telling. The ending also has been modified slightly. In the original ending, the storyteller pauses after the dog dies and then shouts, boo! Several children who heard the story didn't think the ending was scary enough. Bill Tucker, 12, and Billy Green, 12, of Bangor, Maine, suggested they change.
Good work, Bill Tucker and Billy Green. You're right on.
Bangor, hardly newer.
Hey, now we're talking. So scary. I think my favorite was The Thing. I liked that one a lot, where it was just like a fucking zombie walking towards you and then chases you. That's fucked up.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I wrote a scary story to tell in the dark. Inspired.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. Inspired by this last night, I decided to try my hand at the form. And so I've written a scary story in the style of the anthology that I would like to read to you. I didn't do a very good job because it's hard. So actually, when you said it earlier, it's easy. I was like, I don't know. It was hard to like get that style so spare. I was fighting my inclination to elaborate a lot. And I completely failed. Also, I was drunk. So.
On what?
Bourbon.
Just straight.
Bourbon chased by a beer. So let me read to you my scary story. And apologies if you get scared to death. Okay, here we go. One winter, a man was traveling for business, and due to a long travel delay caused by a snowstorm, he didn't check into his hotel until after midnight. The journey from the airport had been long and frustrating. As he stood at his front desk, he felt a sudden pressure. "Could you tell me where the restroom is?" he asked the desk clerk. The clerk gestured towards a short flight of stairs and said, "Just past the ATM." The man thanked him and left his bags with the desk clerk, and he went to the bathroom. Turning the corner by the ATM, he slammed the door open and rushed to the first empty stall he could find. As he relieved himself, he noticed a pair of feet in the stall next to his, wearing old, scuffed sneakers and a pair of dirty jeans bunched around the ankles. Around that time, he also noticed a horrific odor in the bathroom, like a body had been left out to rot. "Gross," he muttered. But just as he did, a moan sounded from the stall next to him. "Oh!"
Oh my God.
The man paused, then asked, "Sir, is everything okay?" There was a pause, then another moan, more urgent this time. "Oh!" "Do you need help? I can go to the desk," the man asked. The voice responded, still moaning, "No, don't." Disturbed, the man pulled up his pants, flushed, went to wash his hands, and returned to the desk as quickly as possible. He finished checking in, went to his room, and fell asleep. In the morning, he checked out and thought nothing of the previous night's incident. A year passed, and the man had reason to travel for business again to the same city. He checked into the same hotel, and as he was heading out later that night, he stopped to use the restroom, remembering it was just up to the flight of stairs and past the ATM. He went to the same stall, sat in the toilet, and saw the same scuffed sneakers and dirty jeans, and smelled the same smell, like a slaughterhouse in the deepest level of hell. And then the same moan. "Oh!" His blood froze. He said nothing in the hopes the man in the next stall would leave, but his feet remained planted on the floor, never moving. Again, the voice moaned. Finally, the man spoke. "Sir, please, is there something I can do?" The voice responded in the same moan. "No, don't." The man left hastily again and left for his business dinner. Several years later, the traveler was in town again and brought some colleagues back to the hotel bar for drinks. As the hours and rounds passed, he found himself he really needs to go to the bathroom. Remembering his previous night's visits, though, he steeled himself. He could just wait and check into his room, he thought. "I'll finish my drink, then I'll leave." He waited and finished his drink, and as he headed just past the lobby, tried to keep his resolve, but the pressure was too great. Buckling, he rushed into the bathroom and nearly ran into the pale, sweaty figure. Looking down, he saw scuffed sneakers, dirty jeans, and staggered back. "You," he stammered. The figure looked him in the eye and said, "Hello, my name is Aaron Black."
Nice.
I couldn't find out about the funny, I couldn't get a good punchline to it, and I was getting sloppier and tired, but that my whole concept was me haunting the Charles Hotel and shitting.
Yeah. Did you?
But also, I thought
you do some illustrations?
I thought about it. I was going to draw like a big stinky poop.
a shit wall, yeah. I think that needs to happen.
Well, listeners, what is your relationship to Scary Stories Tell in the Dark? Did you read it? Did you love it as a kid?
Did you write your own?
Did you write your own about your personal problems? Let us know on Twitter at YakBabies. And of course, email us at yakbabiespodcast@gmail.com to share your thoughts with us. Also, patreon.com/yakbabies, where you can get access to our secret podcast for $1 a month. There's tons of stuff happening there. There's like a Bro-to-Bro Bonanza that's coming your way, and there's a bunch of good stuff in there for sure. There's also games.
Bro-Nanza.
Yeah, we're calling it Bro-Nanza. Ooh, we'll start a second podcast called Bro-Nanza, where we just talk about that stuff. Pick a whole podcast network, and that'll be our next show is Bro-Nanza, and then we'll do Typical Daybeck. All the good shows. So check it out for $1 there. And also we have merch. It's around. You can find a link on our Twitter account somewhere there. There's some shirts and mugs and stuff like that. And they're all very good and very funny. Until then, Yak Babies, yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to thank all their loyal listeners and especially their patrons past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, David, and William Howard Taft.